At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The world's biggest car maker might not be for much longer. Hey, is that a cell phone in your pocket, or are you just being tracked everywhere you go? And short stories of work, fiction, and the jobs we do. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Learn more at CarbonitePro.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here on this Friday, everybody. It's the 22nd of April today. Toyota, the aforementioned world's biggest car company, sold almost 8.5 million cars last year. That is clearly not going to be the case in 2011. The company said today it's going to be at least November before production is back to normal. In Toyota's case, output is down mainly because of damage to suppliers since the earthquake, but only a handful of car companies worldwide have managed to avoid disruptions. So as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports, pretty much everybody's trying to come up with new ways to do business.
Hyundai and Volkswagen both got lucky. Neither company buys many parts from Japan, and the components that are made in Japan come from areas that weren't damaged. Jonathan Browning is CEO of Volkswagen North America, and he says just because VW's escaped so far doesn't mean it's escaped completely.
We're very conscious that a number of layers of the supply base, we don't really know the medium to longer term impact.
That's because each big supplier relies on smaller suppliers, who rely on even smaller suppliers. And car makers often don't know where all the parts originally come from. Today, a Toyota executive admitted the company thought it had multiple sources for some components, only to realize after the earthquake that those suppliers were all relying on the same source. Michael O'Brien is an executive at Hyundai, and he says now car makers will have to change the way they do business. They'll start paying more attention to the entire supply chain.
To make sure that our suppliers that get components from other suppliers do the same things that we do, to ensure that their component can be supplied on an uninterrupted basis.
Beyond worrying about having multiple suppliers for every part, car makers also realize they have to think about different kinds of risks. John Hanke is a consultant to the auto industry.
Even if they're sole sourcing, having those suppliers have multiple plants in different areas that are at risk for different things.
In other words, hedge for different kinds of disasters, natural or otherwise. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
If you've been trying to comment on stories on the New York Times website the past 24 hours or so, you might have run into some trouble. That's because the Times, along with dozens of other companies, hosts at least part of its website on cloud services run by Amazon. Works fine most of the time, but when there's a hiccup like there's been this week, those companies can't do much but hope Amazon can get them back online quickly. And that dependence, as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports, can be costly.
The list of websites hit by this outage include Foursquare, ProPublica, Hootsuite. George Hamilton of the Yankee Group says it was bound to happen.
Amazon is the biggest out there. They're the cloud computing thought leader.
He estimates Amazon controls about 5% of the market. As many as a third of all large companies use the cloud. Amazon has been pitching the reliability of its data centers. Hamilton says they contain something like watertight compartments on a ship, except...
Yeah, sunk the Titanic for 24 hours.
Not all of Amazon's customers sank. Netflix runs on Amazon, and it didn't go down. Neither did the cloud-based software startup Vocado. CEO Fadi Shahade says he still thinks Amazon is reliable. More important, it's cheap.
We were one of the early users of the Amazon cloud. I think our costs per month were under $1,000. I mean, we spent more money on lunches.
It would have cost him hundreds of thousands to buy and maintain servers on his own. But Shahade says he's paid extra for those fail-safes that protected his system, and he expects more companies to do so in the future. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
No trading on Wall Street today, but we'll think of something to say when we do the numbers. Big Brother's out there. He's watching us, and you're carrying him around with you in your purse or your pocket. You've seen or heard the news reports this week that Apple's iPhone and Google's Android phones are keeping detailed files about where you go and that they are sharing that information sometimes with the mothership. We got Marketplace's Steve Henn on the line to talk about this. Hey, Steve.
Hey.
So let me ask you this question as we get going. You know, if you use an ATM or a credit card or a shopper club card, companies know where you are. And companies have been tracking cell phones for a while. What's new about all this stuff that's come out this week?
Well, not a whole lot. Honestly, I think what's really new is that all of a sudden, a lot of people are paying attention. Mm. But companies, industry insiders, reporters, you know, probably a lot of the public have known for years mobile phones can track you and often do track you wherever you go. Maybe the difference is that 5 years ago, it was only really cell phone companies that could track your movements with your phone. Now, companies like Apple and Google are doing it, and even little startups making web apps can do it. So the number of companies tracking you is expanding.
Are they tracking you in greater detail? Tracking us, we should say, in greater detail?
No, just me. No, that actually is changing, you know, and it's getting more and more detailed all the time. Companies are mapping Wi-Fi networks so they can triangulate your position using the Wi-Fi connection in your mobile phone. So they know exactly what street you're on, where on the street you are, even what store you're standing in front of. And, you know, sometimes that's great, but the detail isn't going to stop there. There are stores that would love to know what aisle you're in. And I was talking to a guy who has a startup here in Palo Alto that's using Wi-Fi networks, GPS, and then image recognition hooked into existing security cameras in stores to follow you around from aisle to aisle. The app that guy's building is great if, let's say, you need to find the peanut butter aisle in the Safeway, but it will also give these stores the ability to follow literally your every move.
But if I know where the peanut butter is already, I don't recall being offered a chance to say no to being followed.
Yeah, and I think that is really one of the central issues here. I think lots of people who are upset about these stories don't feel like they were ever given a chance to find out exactly how much data was being collected about them or given a chance to say, you know what, I don't want you to do that. They weren't given an opt-out. The other big issue here, I think the sleeper issue, is security. I've talked to hackers and security consultants who have broken these kinds of tracking systems on cell phone networks wide open. Here's one of them, Don Bailey.
We were able to pretty much get whatever we wanted.
Bailey and his partner, a guy named Nick DiPetrello, reverse engineered the cell phone network to capture all kinds of tracking data on any phone in real time.
Not only could we locate people via their cell phone, we could also locate their devices without them knowing. So if you had a private number, we could easily find it.
Bailey shared all of his findings with the big cell phone companies. And in the U.S., at least, these companies made some fixes. But, you know, as more and more firms collect and store location information about you and me, the possibility for problems like this just multiply.
Marketplace is Steve Henn, somewhere in Silicon Valley. We could track you down if we really wanted to, Steve. Steve, thanks a lot.
Sure, thanks.
The economic news this week has been a combination of political, what with the debt warning on Monday, and corporate, as in earnings season. So our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond is going to kill two birds in one segment. Here to help us do that are Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, also our very own New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore. Lee, Heidi, good to have you back.
Good to be here, Kai. Good to talk to you.
So this will be a weekly wrap in two parts. The first, more concrete. The second, a little bit more zeitgeisty. And Heidi, we're going to start with you. We had technology companies reporting earnings this week. We had manufacturing, which was good. And we had banks making a whole lot of money. What gives?
Well, they're making a lot of money, but they're not really sharing it with anybody else, especially with anyone who needs a job. And that is a big problem for the economy. We're not seeing sort of a trickle-down effect yet where we're seeing the riches that are coming to technology and manufacturing companies and banks actually affecting day-to-day lives of normal people. And in fact, we're seeing more jobs being sent overseas, according to the Commerce Department, than are actually staying here in the United States. So it may take time, but it is a huge and thorny problem.
Can one assume then, Lee, that it means bad things for the recovery?
I don't think necessarily. If you think back to a year ago, I mean, one of the reasons why these earnings were so crazy this week, and they really were, especially in the manufacturing sector, this is because businesses are spending money again, and they're spending on equipment and heavy machinery and semiconductors and technology. And they weren't doing that 1 year ago today. They just weren't. So this may be the first step. And if all goes well, the second step may be hiring. It may be a while. But, you know, they've been sitting on all this cash for a really, really long time, and they're finally starting to put it to use.
Well, that's a nice little turn to the second part of our chat, which is based on the front page of the New York Times today, which says people are feeling less confident about this country. They are more downbeat than they've been in 2 years. Can't possibly be a good thing, Heidi.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And so much of this economy still runs on consumer confidence and consumer behavior. We take a look at huge corporate earnings and we're looking at numbers in the billions, but real people don't deal in those numbers. They need to see their banks lending, which isn't happening. They need to see their manufacturers hiring, which isn't happening. They need to see technology companies making technology that they can afford, which they can't right now because everyone's still paying off their credit card bills and being very tight with money. So it's a huge problem in the sense that, you know, where will the consumer ever get that confidence? If you take a look at the next year, it's really hard to see anything changing in such a massive way that we're going to turn it around. And yet we know we have an economic recovery. It just doesn't seem to be one that we really feel in our hearts.
Lee Gallagher, give me some sunshine. You got to help me out.
Well, I'd agree with that. I mean, consumer confidence has been in fits and starts for the past, I don't know, 12 to 18 months. But right now, it does seem to be in a downturn, and gas prices have a lot to do with that. If you're looking for some sunshine, I mean, a lot of people are talking about what's going to happen with the election next year. So much of this is playing into that right now. And, you know, there's a lot of time for the economy to get better between now and then. And if you look at the stock market, which is not the economy, but it's had a pretty crazy quarter. So there's something there. People on Main Street.
Yeah, but can I tell you how sick I am of the politics of the economy just to get this to Washington and the debt limit and jobs and all that stuff? I mean, it makes you crazy.
It's more politicized than ever. If you look at the reaction in the stock market to the news that S&P had downgraded the government debt this week, it is in the air. And investors are paying attention to that in ways I think they hadn't before. Normally, Washington and the stock market are not totally linked.
Yeah, and I think we can also ask legitimately whether all of the people who control the levers of over the financial markets and the Washington effect on the financial markets right now have all of the information that they need. Because everything that we're hearing about the debt ceiling not being raised is almost apocalyptic. Mm. And yet Washington is not reacting in that way. We need those two factions to start talking and cooperating, and they really do not seem to be.
Heidi Moore. She runs our New York Bureau. Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, good fiction writing and what it tells us about the daily grind.
It tells you that there's more where you thought there was less. It asks you to pay attention where you were wont to rely on conventional intelligence.
But first, let's do the numbers. No stocks, no bonds, no commodities, no nothing on Wall Street and in many other markets around the world today. Traders had the day off for Good Friday. But that doesn't mean there aren't any numbers to be had. Courtesy of the Wall Street Journal this morning, a peek at what the financial industry is doing to influence new regulations that Washington is writing for it. Bank lobbying spending was up almost 3% this quarter from a year ago. Wells Fargo spent the most, almost $2 million. And those lobbyists, boy, they have their work cut out for them. One estimate is that new rules to implement the Dodd-Frank legislation are going to run to 5,000 pages. You're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Carbonite Pro automatically backs up computer files to a secure location with anytime, anywhere access from any computer or smartphone. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for March. Think you'll have a lot of eggs remaining after the weekend? The White House has probably got you beat. During the Easter egg roll, more than 20,000 eggs will be used in the egg roll and egg hunt, decorated on site and eaten for breakfast. And the First Lady of Song was born on April 25, 1917. Jazz singer Ella Fitzgerald won 13 Grammys during her lifetime. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. That debate that they're having in Washington about cutting spending or raising taxes to trim the deficit, eliminating entitlements or closing loopholes, that's old news out in the states. Legislatures and governors have been going down that road for a couple of years now, and it's how lawmakers in Michigan spent this past week. The education budget there is going to be cut, community health programs and prison funding, too. And Republican Governor Rick Snyder wants to fundamentally remake the state's tax code. Michigan Radio's Jennifer Guerra reports.
Michigan was losing jobs even before the recession hit. The state's manufacturing base has been steadily eroding for decades, and other parts of Michigan's economy weren't creating enough jobs to make up for it. Governor Rick Snyder knows where he'd put most of the blame.
We've had a tax system in our state that's been broken a long time.
Snyder says Michigan's tax code takes too big a bite out of small businesses. The thinking goes if they pay less in taxes, they'll have more money to expand and create jobs.
Yeah!
Jerry Grubb owns We Discover, a daycare center in Waterford, Michigan.
I pay taxes on the business, and then all of that income and expenses, etc., flows through to my personal income tax, and I pay tax on it again.
Governor Snyder wants to throw out the state's current business tax and replace it with a 6% tax that would largely fall to corporations. Most small businesses, like We Discover, wouldn't have to pay it.
If the governor's tax proposal went through the way it is, I would be saving probably about 8 or 9% of the tax that I pay currently.
And while he probably wouldn't hire more people with that money, Grubb says he would give his employees a much-needed raise. Now, the tax cuts for small businesses would cost the state about $1.8 billion in revenue. To help make that up, Snyder wants to cut the state's Earned Income Tax Credit, or EITC, for the working poor. Launched in 2006, the tax credit was meant to supplement the federal EITC, given to people who have jobs but who earn less than a certain amount. Last year, the threshold was about $45,000 for a family of four.
The elimination of the Earned Income Tax Credit will push some low-income working families in Michigan into poverty.
Charlie Ballard is an economist at Michigan State University. He points out that everyone from Presidents Ronald Reagan to Bill Clinton have been in favor of the Earned Income Tax Credit. Snyder's plan would eliminate the state portion of the tax credit, which is 20% of the federal EITC. In its place, Snyder would give eligible families $25 a year per child.
We actually have gotten the Earned Income Tax Credit for the last 4 years.
28-year-old Tiffany Blackman makes $20,000 a year as a coordinator at a Michigan food bank. Her husband, Rodrigo, has been unemployed for a year, and they have three kids. Tiffany says after they pay their bills each month, the family has about $60 left over. So the money they get from the state and federal government helps.
We use it to kind of keep us afloat throughout the year. Like our car repairs, anything with our children's school clothes, you know, all of that is essentially coming back from any tax refund that we get back.
Last year, they got about $5,000 from the federal EITC and about $900 from the state.
And over the last 4 years, which we've been getting this, I really feel like there's hope in the boat out of poverty.
Don Grimes is an economist at the University of Michigan. He says when the state first started to offer the EITC, Michigan was relatively wealthy and could afford it.
Now we're a relatively poor state. So you have to wonder if at what point Michigan has that responsibility to providing essentially welfare to lower income working people.
Snyder hopes the state's lawmakers, the majority Republican, will pass his tax proposal as is by May. I'm Jennifer Guerra for Marketplace.
Most days on this broadcast, we talk in one form or another about work, individual contributions to it, or industrial output of it. But straight economic reporting can be somewhat dry. So today, as part of our series, The Art of Money, what artists and others see when they look at the economy, an interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Richard Ford. He's got a new anthology he's put together called Blue Collar, White Collar, No Collar. Short fiction, touching on the theme of what we do every day to get by. Richard Ford, good to talk to you.
Glad to be here.
I realize this is a conversation about the art of writing about work, but I wonder if you would oblige me by relating the story you tell in your introduction about your mother when she found out that you had gotten what she considered your first real job.
Well, I grew up in Mississippi of Depression era, I suppose you'd say, parents, and having a job was very important to them. It sort of meant what character was to them, how you earned a living. And so when I set away from that track to be a novelist, I think it dismayed my mother in lots of ways. And so after I published a couple of books, my mother was visiting me in Princeton where my wife and I lived, and I had just gotten this job offered in Princeton, and it wasn't much of a job, and I didn't think it was much of a job. But when I told my mother I was going to take it for a year, she said, "Oh, Richard, my God, I'm so glad you've finally gotten started." I thought I was pretty well started, but not in my mother's eyes, not until I had a job and a paycheck coming in.
What is it about writing about work that helps a story when you describe a character's professions and occupation?
When my father would come home from his job, which was a job of a traveling salesman, and tell us about the people that he knew on the road, you always knew what they did first. Their sense of character, their sense of plausibility was expressed bottom line in what they did for a living. Consequently, when I started trying to make up characters and put them on the page, that carried over into my life.
You know, it's interesting, though, because it's one thing to read news reports and to listen to radio stories about unemployment and joblessness and the shaky state of the American economy. It's entirely another, though, to read that in fiction. Somehow it's even more impactful.
Well, that's what fiction's good at. I mean, fiction's good at immersing you in the details, which the headline don't convey. And if you only hear politicians talking about, well, we need to cut back on this amount of money, we don't make that connection. And it is a connection that fiction can make.
I wonder if you would do us a favor and read a section from one of your stories that's included in this. It's a story called Under the Radar, about a couple, Stephen and Marjorie Reeves. They're going toward dinner with another couple when Marjorie tells Stephen she's had an affair with the host of this party they're going to.
They were extremely young. Stephen Reeves was 28, Marjorie Reeves a year younger. They weren't rich, but they'd been lucky. Stephen's job at Packard Wells was to stay on top of a small segment of a larger segment of a rather small prefabrication intersection that serviced the automobile industry, and where any sudden alteration or even the rumor of an alteration in certain polymer bonding formulas could tip crucial down-the-line demand patterns and in that way affect the betting lines and comfort zones of a good many meaningful client positions.
You know, that technical description of what he does for a living, it sounded to me like death. I'd be bored stiff doing that, you know?
It sounded to me like death when I wrote it, too. You know, people's relationship to their work is focal in American culture. It is the thing that grounds us. And so attention to it, even morose or funny or bitter or acerbic attention to it, seems never inappropriate.
You have some amazing writers in this compilation. I mean, George Carroll Oates, Alice Munro, Eudora Welty, Tobias Wolff. How has reading their work changed your view of what writing about work means?
What I have found in choosing these stories is that the stories are quite wonderful in dedicating felicitous language to things that we thought we knew about and distinguished intelligence to what we thought we knew about, but in fact turn out to reveal more than we thought we knew about. Because that finally is the life-affirming quality of literature, is it It tells you that there's more where you thought there was less. It asks you to pay attention where you will want to rely on conventional intelligence.
Richard Ford has edited a new anthology. It's called Blue Collar, White Collar, No Collar, Stories of Work. There is more of it on our Big Book blog. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook. Richard Ford, thank you so much.
It's nice to talk to you, Kai. Thanks a lot.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note as we wrap up, time on a Friday to check the news that didn't quite make the headlines, comes to us the same way it always does, courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Francis Noonan, and select members of the Marketplace staff.
Millie Jefferson, director, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, there's an employment agency in Central Florida that's partially funded by the government that wants to spend $14,000 to buy red capes, red superhero capes, for unemployed people.
What?
It's part of their community outreach to engage the unemployed in their community, draw them in so they can help them find jobs.
They're going to do this by giving them capes.
They say so that it's that they can fight evil Mr. Unemployment.
How much? It sounds more like a plot hatched by the evil Captain Condescension.
Avishai Artsy, assistant producer for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Mommy Juice.
Do you need me to leave for a second?
Actually, Mommy Juice is a wine company that's being sued by another company called Mommy's Time Out because of their name.
But I take it Mommy Has a Problem is still available as a name.
I think so. I mean, this is an issue of trademark violation.
Not an issue of violation of good taste.
I think if your wine's called Mommy Juice, taste isn't really an issue.
Ethan Lindsay, producer of Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
The German circus. Two German circus families got into a fight this week. Police had to break it up. They confiscated knives, guns, and a baton. One guy had a gunshot to the leg.
I guess this is what they mean by family entertainment. Why did they fight?
There are differing accounts. Some reports say they aren't really sure. One report said it was over who got to the tent space first.
I think it's over. They've just finally packed one too many clowns into that little car. They're just like, we've had enough.
Get your shoe out of my face.
There is oh so much more where that came from. Their podcast is called The Dinner Party Download, and you can find the link to it on our website. It's marketplace.org. And for now, that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yule. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. Starting your own business often means going without health insurance.
During the time when I was very sick, it really did make me think I wish I'd stayed in teaching because I would have health coverage.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're back Monday afternoon, same time, same channel. Have yourself a great weekend. This is APM, American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.